Cooney, reel two.
When you got to Gourock, what were your first experiences there? Did you find, for example, the officers' mess an entirely new experience?
It was, but I had a jolly good time there. I'm afraid I suffered a little because I hadn't been to Sandhurst. Small boys do that sort of thing, you know.
Can you give me any examples of the difficulties you felt as a result of that?
No, there was a few of us we rather looked down on because we hadn't been to public schools in Sandhurst. But it didn't worry us much at all, really.
Yes. Was that just a general feeling, or did it have any overt symptoms?
Oh, no, it hadn't. People naturally clustered together in gangs, you know. Mm. Young men, those who'd been to Sandhurst, all kept together, and those who hadn't usually herded together and had found something in common, you know.
Tell me this story about your first visit to the officers' mess.
Oh, that awful story of the dear old major. Well, the mess was in a very large house. We were quartered in it. The officers' mess was there, and it was a great big long dining room. There was a long table all down the middle of it, and one side of it there was the fireplace, and the opposite corner there was the entrance, and I was feeling rather frightened my first meal. And I said to the mess sergeant the night before, "What's the earliest I can have my breakfast?" And he said, 7 o'clock, sir. And I said, "Right, I'll be down at 7. And when I got down at 7 o'clock, there was an old gentleman. Well, I thought he was an old gentleman. He was a senior major, sitting facing the fire and having his breakfast. So I said, "Good morning, sir." And he rather grunted. And I sat down on the opposite side of the table with my back to the fire on one side. And I ploughed through my breakfast without saying anything. He was reading his paper. And eventually, when I got to the marmalade stage, I said, "Excuse me, sir, but will you pass me the marmalade? Or may I trouble you for the marmalade," I think was what I said. And he got up and he walked all the way around the table to the fireplace and he pressed the bell and he walked all the way back and sat down. And when the waiter came in, he said, "This gentleman wants the marmalade." Which really put me in my place pretty well. I don't think I've ever asked anybody for the marmalade since, as far as I can remember.
Yes. Now, while you were at Gourock, you obviously had some specific functions, some specific jobs. What were you doing?
Oh, doing there simply individual training. Mostly individual training, personal training as an officer and with the soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Training them up to the standard of the end of their recruit training. They could go out and join a regular unit in the battle zone.
Yeah.
Nothing very remarkable, I think. Quite a normal procedure.
Yes. I think your initials of RC
cause
one peculiar misunderstanding.
Yes. Yes. The first Sunday I was detailed to take the Roman Catholic Church parade, and of course, being recruiting in the Clydeside, we had a very large proportion of Irishmen who were all Roman Catholics, several hundred of them anyway at that time, and I found myself marching down to the Roman Catholic Church, about 300 men behind me. And a large sergeant major beside me. And on the way down, he sort of spoke quietly, saying, "Excuse me, sir, but are you a Roman Catholic?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And he said, "Perhaps you'd sit behind the men and not in front of them. Otherwise, you'll do the wrong thing and they'll all copy you." Which I thought was rather nice.
How was it that you got the job?
Oh, because my initials were asking in some clerk, I should think. And probably just put the name down.
Transferred the initials to the other side of your surname.
I think that's probably what it was. I can't think of any other reason. There's no other reason, because normally they're very careful about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Just a slip somewhere.
Now, one of the jobs that you had while you were in Scotland was out of Scotland. You were sent down to London again, to Clapham Common, on a bombing
course. Oh, that's right,
course.
On a bombing, the first bombing course that was held.
I'm very interested indeed about this. What kind of bombs and bomb training did you
have?
Well,
it was quite elementary, because the bomb had only been recently introduced into the service in the war, and this was the first course. And it was set up on Clapham Common behind an enormous corrugated iron screen with a big circular area. And there was a lot of security about it. A few people went into it. And it was a week's course. And they taught us about the hand bomb, which was just a thing like a cricket ball made of iron, I suppose, or light. And loaded with aminal, I think, and it had a fuse, and you had a brassard on your arm, and you took the waterproof top off and struck the lighter, and the fuse burnt. You held it while you counted five, and then you threw it. And when it landed, it was time when it went off. But unfortunately, the first chap took us out to demonstrate it. He'd thrown his bomb, and somehow or another, a large dog that had got in ran after it, picked it up, came back with it. Which somewhat startled the audience, and they went in all directions. But they didn't get hurt. The poor old dog lost its head, and that's all. And they had one or two gadgets there. They had... oh dear, I've forgotten the Latin name, but a thing that threw bombs, a sling, a mechanical sling. There's a Latin name for it, which I used to know quite well. I've forgotten it. And it merely wound it up and pulled the elastic back, put the bomb in, pressed the trigger, and off went the bomb into the enemy's trench, if you were lucky.
This was sort of sounds like a medieval device.
Exactly, it's what it was. It's what it was.
And they used it for launching the same bombs that you had been practicing throwing by hand?
No, I'm not sure. I've rather forgotten. No, I think, yes, I think certainly that, and perhaps others too. Mm. And we had an awful thing called a red pepper bomb.
What was that?
That was a thing about the size of a small football made of cardboard, painted black, with its ordinary fuse and things like that, and stuffed with an explosive charge and red pepper. And it was for use in the dugout. When you came to an occupied dugout, you popped one of these things down, and the Boche came up the other entrances.
Was this ever actually used in France?
I don't know. Uh-huh. That I don't know. It wasn't used when I was in France. I didn't see one.
Yes.
But whether it had been used before or since, I don't know.
I've spoken to quite a number of people who have told me interesting stories about Clapham Common. People who were in wireless and used it for practicing erecting aerial masks. Just as one example, but a great many other people who seem to have trained. Clapham Common seems to have been given over to a good deal of military training.
Maybe. I only experienced that one week of it, mm-hmm. and so that's all I know.
Did it appear to you to be organised as a military training centre, or was it just a patch of grass?
No, I just went out by tube from Piccadilly Circus, where I lived, and walked about 200 or 300 yards into this corrugated iron enclosure and came out again and went back to Piccadilly Circus, and that's all I knew about it.
Yes. There was a second course which you went on. I think this must have been towards the middle of 1916.
15 years.
15, was
15,
it?
Yeah.
This was a...
No, that's right. It was getting on in 16, that's right.
This was a musketry course.
At Strensel.
Strensaw. This was near York, wasn't it?
That's right, close to York.
Yes.
It was a camp close to York.
Yes.
And it's the ordinary musketry course which every musketry instructor did. It was a sort of small hythe. Hythe was the big musketry course before the war. And these were just command musketry schools. And I came down and did that course.
Yeah, I think you met some interesting people there.
Eric Coates. He shared a room with Eric Coates, the composer.
What sort of chap was he?
Oh, a very nice chap, a bit of an old woman. He arrived with a box full of brushes and polishes and rags to keep the room clean. Had everything highly organised. But I must confess, I didn't know much about him. He was a good deal older than I was.
Yes. And another character...
And Long Hay, Tim Hay in the Black Watch, who was the tallest man in the army, he was 7 foot tall. And when he stood at attention, he couldn't hold the top of his musket at all. He had to bend down like that, touch it. But he had a long career. I met him afterwards on many occasions, and he was a very good officer. Uh-huh. At one time, I believe, he was attached to or seconded to the Gurkhas, who were all tiny little men about as high as his knee. But he was a very nice man. I knew him well.
Your training,
the staff college.
Mm-hmm. Your training completed. You were posted to France in July of 1916.
That's right.
Did you go there with your battalion, or
no,
as part of a draft?
As a draft.
I see.
The rule then was that you were not to be sent. They introduced it all to our fury. Not to be sent to France until you were 19. And I crossed over to France on my 19th birthday, the 8th of July.
Did you go straight into action, or was there some more training?
No,
first?
There was a lot more training. They had a thing called the Bullring at Etap, where they sent us for 2 or 3 weeks, I can't remember exactly. And again, they put us all through basic training with special reference to trench warfare.
Tell me about the special reference to trench warfare.
Well, it was just... really, it was a matter of carrying out raids. How small raids were carried out on platoon or company basis. And things like gas, which was a new weapon, we had that to do.
Well, let's concentrate on one at a time. How were you trained to organise raids, trench raids, on a company or platoon basis?
Well, I think you were trained in the way in which they were organised, which is put down a sort of box barrage to protect the enemy area from counterattack, and then it was shelled, and at a certain time you went in with your troops, and the object of taking, usually the object of taking prisoners and collecting information of the regiments in the line and any other information you get out of them. But that was the chief object. That, and of course, to maintain your aggressive spirit. Trench warfare was a very dull and boring business, and occasional raids kept you on your toes.
Yes, that's interesting.
And the German did the same thing against us, you see.
Yes. I have heard from a number of people a certain amount of criticism of this principle of trench raids. They felt that it created more problems than it actually solved, and there's some suggestion that it would have been perhaps a good deal more prudent to live and let live rather than sort of stir things up, and the trench raids just caused a necessary number of casualties without securing any useful ends.
Well, this, of course, is a major problem. The ordinary British soldier, certainly in that war, and from what I saw in the Second War, if he could, would have made love to his German opposite numbers. They did on Christmas Day in 1914. They all stopped fighting and shared their food in between. Only too anxious to do so, because although many people can't understand, there was no ill feeling in the field of battle between the opposing sides. No individual. You didn't dislike the chap opposite you in any way. In fact, when you got to know him, he was a rather nice chap like yourself. And the same thing was inclined to happen in the Second War. We had to take, I was in the desert in the Second War, and we had to take strong steps to prevent, I've forgotten what they called it, making friends with the enemy.
Yeah. Were there any other devices by which the maintenance of an aggressive spirit against the enemy were inculcated?
Not really. There was the famous Ronnie Campbell's bayonet fighting course, which was one of the best. I knew Ronnie Campbell very well. He was a colonel in the Gordon Highlanders. I knew him after the war too. And he used to go around lecturing. Had a first-class lecture on the use of the bayonet. And bayonet fighting was one of those things which you had to practice against dummies outside the line, and the idea was that it would make you a good bayonet fighter. Well, whether it did that or not, I don't know.
I've heard about bayonet courses before, but I've not heard about Ronnie Campbell before. Was there something peculiar about Ronnie Campbell's bayonet course?
Except that it was absolutely superb. He was damn good. He was a very good instructor, and his lecturing was quite first class. Yes. He used to go round the troops lecturing to them, and you'd see them by the time he'd finished, they would all be sitting on the end of their seats.
Raring to go.
Yes. Yes. Quite astonishing he was.
Yes. This preliminary period of training when you first got to France at Etaples, you said you here learnt for the first time about gas. How was that subject introduced to you?
That was by lectures and a practice, a certain practice. We had a thing called a pH helmet, which you've probably heard of, which was what's the name of it now?
Balaclava?
It was, you pulled it right over your head. It was a sack made of not canvas, flannel, thick flannel, impregnated with chemical, which prevented stopped chlorine getting through. And it had two eyes, and it had a valve, which you shucked, and you breathed in through your helmet and out through this valve, which had a flap called the pH helmet, and you tucked into your shoulders, and it was very effective. You didn't feel any bad effects. And they dug a trench underground, and they had a chlorine generator in the middle, and then we all had to go through it with these things tucked in. But when the one I went through, somebody fell over in the middle of it, and there was a lot of disturbance. Nobody got hurt. Nobody got gassed, but we all thought we were going to get gassed. But otherwise, that's all there was until the new gas mask came out.
Mm. Any other anti-gas training? Any other instruction in how to overcome the problems?
There were the ordinary alarm, which I think has rattles or something like that. I've rather forgotten. Mm-hmm. There was a system of alarm for gas, which everybody had to be very careful about, because it was a very unpleasant weapon, and it went down into the trench and into the dugout, and if anybody was not prepared for it, they got caught. There was a training in making, when it was all over, getting the stuff out of the way and that sort of thing. I've rather forgotten it.
How was that achieved?
With flaps. Disturbing all the air until it was dispersed. But it was... I'd rather forgotten it. I never got caught in a gas attack. I caught in gas shells, but not in a chlorine gas attack.
I see.
So I had no practical experience of that.